Back on downtown. It's time for Message in the Bottle, brought to you by Bangor Wine and Cheese Company, 86 Hammond Street in downtown Bangor. Eric Meehan, or is it Henry Higgins, joins us. Hello, sir.
Oh, my goodness. Did I just give Carrie a conniption fit?
You did. What did you do to him? Were you being a prankster?
I answered the phone like, hello! And then he responded to me like, I'm not sure if I had the wrong number or if it's Eric being an annoying little you-know-what. And it was. It was me being an annoying little know-what. And so I think I really threw him for a loop. And then he's like, okay, well, we're like on. And then the song came on.
It especially threw me, Eric, because we've been having this weird thing with the phones where sometimes I need to dial a one, sometimes I don't, and I had actually had a wrong number just before I connected with you. So, yes, your fake voice threw me.
I will endeavor in the future not to do that to you. I will answer the phone in my normal, sexy, yet gravelly baritone.
The biggest surprise to me is that you don't always answer the phone. Hello?
It just depends on who's calling.
Okay.
You should see me when we get obvious auto dialers at the store. Very bad. Very bad.
I bet.
Especially if we have, I admit to this, and this is something, you know, having been in business for so long, sometimes one loses it. And if you have like a customer in front of you or a sales rep or whatever that you can play with, I'll answer the phone and just, you know, say the oddest things to see what their reaction is, because it's always kind of fun. No one can quite believe it, which is, you know, it's always a good time. It's just an amazing thing. I mean, for instance, just yesterday I got a call. And this is not the first time within the last couple weeks that it's happened that I got a call for the former owner of the store. I mean, I've owned the store for literally over a decade at this point. Sometimes they catch you on the wrong day and you decide to just have a little fun. And I know that's not just me. Maybe it is. I don't know.
No.
Anyway, I don't think so. There's definitely, I've been in rooms where auto callers have caught other people on the wrong day at the wrong time, and it's just glorious to watch. If, for instance, your previous caller Dennis, I believe if you're a truly good actor, you can really, really have some fun with people. So I just offer that up.
I may or may not have done that a few times through the years. I especially like doing it with accents.
Yeah, well, that's fun.
Yeah,
that's fun. Or it's not so much that, is really, I like to try and suss out why a telemarketer is calling, and I always feel like I never want to make the caller feel bad, because those people earn nothing.
True.
I mean, literally. So I never do that, but I always am just trying to be like, what, you know, it's amazing. Anyway, this is a topic for another time. By the way, speaking of Dennis, I applaud his recommendation to everyone to, if not run for office, at least volunteer your time, get involved. It's so important, especially these days. So well done on his part. And it's so true, like what he said about there are seats sitting open, you know, in many parts of this country. And I think there's a great deal that people are unaware of, and I think that's one of those things. I think people just automatically assume that there's always people running, there's always people doing things, and I think as someone who I try to make it a point to always be involved in something, I've been afraid to run for office, though I've talked about it with several folks who have and who sit there now or have in the past, and it's a scary thing, because I always lost popularity contests in school, you know what I mean? But at the same time, you can't be afraid of it, because, you know, there's otherwise the wrong sort of people can sort of, steer things in the wrong direction. I mean, I saw what you posted earlier on Facebook, sir, things like that just give you heart palpitations.
Yeah.
Anyway, things that can help your heart include wine.
Thank goodness.
And that's what I'm here to talk about today. So our subject today is one of my favorite, actually, right? So I call it the Tempranillo Belt and the Frenchianization of Spain. And what this is to say is that Spain was really sort of in a wine purgatory for a long time. They were trying to figure themselves out, what their identity was. They had a lot of grapes, as everybody did, and one of the chief reasons they had a lot of different grapes is because the Romans brought them, right? I mean, this is the, if there's a constant dialogue in any wine story, it's that the Romans basically came around and planted stuff, and before them the Greeks, and before them the Phoenicians, things like this. But they didn't really do anything with them that was going to earn them international fame. And then our favorite bug, the phylloxera louse, started to eat vineyards in the mid-1800s. And, of course, by the late 1800s, it basically decimated all the vineyards of Europe. But what the French wine growers, what it first did was that they emptied into Spain. And as we discussed last week there with Catalonia, there's really only two entry points into Spain unless you're a tremendous rock climber, and that is through Catalonia or through the Basque region, which leads straight down the French coast through San Sebastian, if anybody knows where that is. And if you do and have been there, you're a very lucky person because it's beautiful. And then down into the region that we are going to start to call this sort of a Tempranillo belt. And that is the start of Navarra, then, of course, the very famous region of Rioja. And then it hits the Douro or Duero River, depending on which country of Iberia you're in. And it followed the river down to regions like Ribera del Duero, Toro, and then down through Portugal, where it's used heavily as well. And so what did the French do? Well, the French, they brought the concept of barrel aging and blending. And so before Tempranillo really became the chief grape, it was still an important grape, but there was a lot of other really cool, important grapes like Matura Tinta, Mazuelo, and many others. And if you read treatises from the early part of this century, or I'm sorry, I guess the last century now, so the early 1900s, there were like 80 grapes described, but the French brought this concept of, you know, if you blend this and blend this and blend this according to the vintage, you're going to end up with a better overall wine. And the other thing they said is if you age them in barrels, at least the wines that could take it, right, the ones that are a little more tannic, a little bit more built to age, you will end up with something that can be transported, be marketed, and thus began Spain's wine culture as we sort of now know it. Unfortunately, as happens in many, many places, homogenization took hold. Tempranillo is a grape that favors a shortened growing season. And the reason that's important, as I'll often remind people, is that Spain, elevation-wise, is the second highest country in Europe. Obviously, the coast is at sea level, but when you go in from the coast in many, many regions, basically by the time you get to Madrid, which is obviously the center of the country, you are on a very, very high plateau, and much of Spain is a fairly high plateau with a lot of mountain ranges. And subsequently, Tempranillo just grew better and grew more favorably given whatever conditions happened vintage. So that is why we see a lot of Tempranillo there. And it's not that it's a bad grape. It's a delicious grape. But that's why it's sort of the predominant one, especially in that area. Carrie, may I get a time check, sir?
4.5 minutes, sir.
Oh, my goodness. All right, well, we're very good. So, yeah, a little bit about the time frame here, right? So when we're talking about the Tempranillo belt and the marketability, we didn't really start to see Spanish wines on the international market for a while. So here's the rough timeline, right? We talked about the emptying of France and then sort of the destruction of many of the vineyards of Europe happening around the mid-1800s to the later 1800s. Now, Spain, because of its elevated altitude, as well as a lot of the particular regions they had, as we've talked about in places like Chile and Argentina and other places where the climate is a little bit drier, is a little bit less hospitable to both funguses and then also the ground itself is not hospitable to the phylloxera louse. So you do see in Spain a lot of pre-phylloxera planting. And the reason is, and the reason why a lot of the people came down there is because of all the vineyards that were being destroyed, the Spanish ones, some of them weren't. So, I mean, if you're a winemaker, you're going to go to the place where you can make wine. So that's really what happened. But then, of course, what ended up sort of stunting all that, as is typical, is war. So what you had was, you had a Portuguese Revolution in 1910. You had World War One. You had Franco in Spain, as well as the Estado Novo in Portugal. And that was starting when my father was born. So my father was born in 1938. This was in 1939. Then you had World War II. The dictatorships in both of these countries lasted until the mid-70s. So there was no marketing internationally of the Spanish wine that we enjoy today, which is why a lot of people still sort of see it as a new thing, right? It was, as recently as 5 years ago, the next thing that Americans will discover, which is, of course, absurd, but it's, you know, that's, again, that's what marketing is, and that's what, you know, wars and dictatorships and stuff will do to you. Speaking of dictatorships, in the short time I have left, I will be posting about who you can write to about the tariffs. That'll be on our Facebook page and our newsletter that's finally been announced. I've finally gotten the information. And I hope that your listeners will take the time to drop a brief letter to our government saying, boy, I wish you wouldn't do that. And in the meantime, I will remind people, if you want to come into Bangor Wine and Cheese, we require a mask unless you medically cannot wear one, at which point we will make an appointment for you to come in and get you in there when no one else is in there. And we are still doing curbside pickup, so please feel free to continue that if that's how you feel best to purchase from us. And continued thanks to everyone for being so gracious about it. And I'm probably out of time, so gentlemen, you tell me.
Yes, you are. I did want to mention on our way out, with just a few seconds left, the cider in a bag is wonderful.
Yes, isn't it? I tried it. I had to. Cool. Yes, we now have cider in a bag. Really good farmhouse cider from Farnham Hill. It's so good, as just been attested to. So we got wine in a bag. We got cider in a bag. No beer in a bag yet, but that's probably for the best, and you could probably figure out why.
Yeah, and me half in the bag, so we're almost home.
Wonderful. Oh, goodness. All right, guys. I'll talk to you all next week.
Thanks, Eric. Eric Meehan, Bangor Wine and Cheese Company. Call the store and see if he answers the phone. Hello?